Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, July 21st, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the future of mandatory union dues. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome experts Scott Cronlund and William Messenger. More complete bios were provided you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here to preserve more time for their presentations of about 20 minutes, followed by your questions. With that, Mr. Messenger, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Will, for the Federal Society for setting up this conference call. And the way Scott and I have decided to divide the opening remarks is I'm going to give sort of a background of the case law in the past, leading from Abood up to Friedrichs. And then from there, Scott's going to talk about what's going on presently as far as cases that are still pending after Friedrichs. So I think a good place to start with all of this is with Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which was the first case to decide whether it was constitutional to require public employees to pay union dues as a condition of employment. And what the Abood majority says was, yes, they can be required, but only to a certain extent. Abood held that employees can be required to pay for union costs of collective bargaining and things related to collective bargaining, such as contract administration and grievance adjustment. However, the court held it was unconstitutional to require that employees pay for things that are political or ideological in nature. So really, the core of Abood is this dichotomy between collective bargaining on one hand, which is chargeable under the First Amendment, and political and ideological expenses, which are not constitutional, to be charged under the First Amendment. And one of the primary rationales of the Abood Court for finding it was lawful to charge for collective bargaining is what's called the free rider rationale. And the rationale is the idea that since the union exclusively represents everyone in the bargaining unit and has a duty to represent everyone in the bargaining unit, everyone should pay for that representation. Otherwise, if an employee didn't pay, they'd be so-called free riding on the union's costs of representation. So that's the main rationale behind Abood for the chargeable for collective bargaining. Now, there was a dissent in Abood. It was technically a concurrence in the judgment because they overruled a lower court, but it was really dissent. And what Justice Powell held in this concurrence and dissent was that there is no distinction between collective bargaining and political activities in the public sector. In either case, the government is on the receiving end of the speech, whether it's bargaining or lobbying. At the end of the day, the union is trying to influence government policy, and therefore this distinction Abood made, the Abood majority, between collective bargaining and politics doesn't really exist. But as noted, that was a dissenting view, and to this day, Abood remains the law of the land in that dichotomy. Now, since Abood, which again was decided in 1977, there's been a lot of litigation over exactly how to implement that decision in terms of procedures and what's chargeable. And one of the big issues that has come up, and it's worth noting because it'll come up again, is whether or not employees can be required to object to paying for political expenses or if the union needs their consent to charge for political expenses. It's often called the opt-in, opt-out issue. In other words, do employees have to opt in to paying for union fees or do they have to affirmatively opt out? Unions generally take the position that employees have to opt out. And so a union will, in most jurisdictions, will charge a non-member employee full union dues and only deduct the fees for political expenses and ideological expenses if the employee affirmatively objects. And some unions, in fact, require annual objections, meaning that the employee, non-member employee has to object every single year to paying for political expenses, otherwise they will pay full union dues. The lower courts have generally upheld objection requirements. However, there's a circuit split with respect to whether or not annual objection requirements are constitutional. And so sort of fast forward the story to 2012, because more or less things remain more or less the same, the core of Abood in place, until you came to two decisions. One is called Knox versus SEIU, and the second is called Harris v. Quinn. And I just want to go through them quickly because they sort of set the stage for Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. So the first case up was Knox, Knox versus SEIU. And the question in Knox was whether when a union charges a special fee, does it need consent from non-members to pay that fee, or can it just take that fee and allow them to object in the future? So the facts in that case was an SEIU local in California charged a special assessment for what are called a political fight back fund, which was mostly used to oppose some ballot initiatives that the union didn't like. The non-member employee said, you should not be able to take this special fee from us without our consent, or at the very least, we should get a notice and an opportunity to object to it. The union, on the other hand, said, well, you can object during the next fiscal year, and it will all work out in the wash. The Ninth Circuit upheld the union's position. The Supreme Court then took the case and reversed. And what the Supreme Court held was when the special fee is assessed, the union cannot assess that fee to non-members without their consent and without providing a new notice. But what was really important about Knox, though, is some of the things the court said on the way to that conclusion. And there are really three things. The first is that the Knox majority called Abood an anomaly and sharply criticized the free rider rationale. I believe the analogy they used is, look, a lot of people benefit from the advocacy of groups. It doesn't mean they can be forced to pay for it. And sort of suggested that should be true of unions also. The second is that on the objection requirement, the court held that it sort of went through its prior precedents concerning the objection requirement and construed them to say, look, this idea of an objection has come about more from an historical accident, more from any sort of constitutional adjudication, really strong look at the issue. And the court criticized the objection requirement, the idea of employees having to opt out. And then finally, the Knox majority made clear that compulsory union fees were subject to exacting constitutional scrutiny, which means they have to be justified by compelling government interests and be the least restrictive means to that interest. And while some prior opinions, you could sort of parse that standard out a little bit, that was the first time the court had really explicitly said, this is subject to this heightened level of scrutiny. And so you take those three things together, what was rather apparent was the court was signaling it had questions about the validity of Abood and the validity of opt-in, opt-out, or I'm sorry, opt-out requirements. But at the end of the day, the Knox decision was limited to that special fee. So the next case up was Harris versus Quinn. Harris was filed long before Knox was decided by the Supreme Court. In fact, Harris was already on a cert petition and fully briefed before the Knox decision had come out, but it happened to be the next compulsory fee case at the Supreme Court after Knox. And what was at issue in Harris versus Quinn was whether or not individuals who were not full-fledged government employees could be required to pay union dues under Abood. And so what you had in Harris, the state of Illinois, amongst a couple other states, had decided to unionize Medicaid providers. These were home personal care providers who provided home-based care to people with disabilities and were paid by a Medicaid program for so doing. In many cases, these were actually parents or relatives of the person with disabilities. And the state and the unions took the position of, well, these individuals are partially or jointly employed by the state because the state Medicaid program pays for their services, even though they're not fully employed by the state because actually the person with disabilities hires them, supervises them, and takes other functions. And so the question in Harris was, did Abood reach this far? And the petitioners in Harris really made two arguments. The first is, A, the court should just overrule Abood based on some of the things it said in Knox, and that would solve the problem. Or number two, it should limit Abood to employment relationships. And the court in Harris, the court majority, basically chose option B, to limit Abood. But what the court did, and sort of go in more detail, is first it strongly criticized Abood. In fact, it spent two or three pages laying out all the reasons it thought Abood was wrongly decided. In particular, it focused on this idea, going back to Justice Powell, that there is no difference between collective bargaining and politics in the public sector. Both are speech directed at government trying to influence government policy. And even if there was a conceptual difference, you couldn't work out as a practical matter because they were so indistinguishable. However, the court ultimately stopped short of overruling Abood, saying that it didn't need to decide the case. And it held that Abood only reaches full-fledged government employees and that no compelling state interest justified compelling these Medicaid providers to pay compulsory union fees. And so that was Harris. That was 2014. The next case up was Friedrichs versus California's Teachers Association. This was filed after Knox, but before Harris. Friedrichs was a case expressly designed to overrule Abood. And it really presented two questions. One, can employees be forced to pay anything to a union? And then two, are objection requirements legal? The case moved relatively fast. In fact, the plaintiffs in that case actually filed for judgment against themselves at the lower courts in order to expedite its path to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court took the case. And the argument was similar to what the court laid out in Harris, the petitioners made, as far as why it should be overruled. And Scott, I can go into some of the various arguments back and forth if anyone's interested later. But so Friedrichs was before the court in those two issues. Argument was held, oral argument, in January of this year. And based off that oral argument, virtually everyone, including myself, was strongly of the opinion that the court was probably going to overrule Abood. Now, no one knows that for sure, obviously. You know, sometimes justices are coy at oral argument. They could change their minds down the road. But that oral argument strongly suggested that Abood was going to be overruled by a 5-4 vote. Because looking at the Harris votes, you can sort of get a good idea of who was where on this issue. However, in February, Justice Scalia, of course, passed away. And as a result of his passing, the court deadlocked. And soon thereafter issued a 4-4 affirmance. What that means is the Supreme Court was unable to come to a decision, and so the lower court decision, that being the Ninth Circuit decision, stands. So Abood remains the law of the land after Friedrichs. Now, the Friedrichs petitioners then filed a petition for a hearing that was held for quite a while, but during the last conference of the term, the court denied it. So the Friedrichs case is now over. And so that sort of brings us up more or less to present day. And with that, turn it over to Scott, and he can talk about the various cases that are now pending, working their way through the lower courts dealing with similar issues.
Thanks, Bill. I'm going to briefly describe some of the issues that are now being litigated in the lower courts. The 4-4 affirmance and Friedrichs left the law where it has been for a long time, and now there are cases in the lower courts that seek to change the law as Friedrichs did. The first category of cases are cases seeking to overrule Abood. There are several of them pending. Most of them were put on hold pending the Supreme Court's ruling in Friedrichs. None of them has yet reached a federal circuit court or a state Supreme Court. Abood was decided in 1977. It's been the law since that time, and a case seeking to overturn Abood's holding that workers can be required to pay fair share fees for the costs of collective bargaining representation would have to be resolved by the Supreme Court. In the lower courts, it's controlled by precedent. There are also cases that present the same opt-out issue that was presented in Friedrichs. The law has been clear back to Machinists v. Street, which was a 1961 Railway Labor Act case, that the burden is on workers who don't want to pay for political expenditures to say so. The cases seek to overturn that line of authority. And again, it would seem like that's an issue that could only be overturned by the Supreme Court. There are also at least six cases pending that seek to obtain a ruling that exclusive representative collective bargaining by itself, even if workers don't have to pay any fair share fees to the union, is an impingement on First Amendment rights that, at least as to the type of workers at issue in Harris, workers who aren't full-fledged public employees, violates the First Amendment. Thus far, every court to consider that argument has rejected it. The first case was a case called D'Agostino v. Patrick that was resolved by the First Circuit, and cert was denied this year. There are at least five other cases pending at various levels of the federal court system that raise the same argument about exclusive representation. After the Harris decision, there are also several cases brought seeking to recover fair share fees that home care or child care workers had paid before the Harris decision. Those cases are still being litigated in the courts. There is at least one ruling that the union has a good faith defense to having to pay damages for fees collected prior to Harris. That ruling was appealed, and it's now before the Second Circuit with arguments set at the end of August. There also are several court decisions that have denied motions for class certification in such cases on the rationale that it's not possible to determine without individualized testimony whether the workers had any objection to paying the fair share fees. The records in those cases show that after the Harris decision, most of the workers who were fair share payers decided to join the union and continue to provide financial support to the union rather than to become free riders. There's also a case pending in California called Bain v. California Teachers Association that argues that union members have a right to receive all of the benefits of union membership, such as members-only benefits, the right to vote for union leadership, without paying for full union dues. The argument is being made that the First Amendment entitles the workers to be able to enjoy the benefits of union membership, but not pay for the non-chargeable expenses of the union. Thus far, that argument has been rejected, and it would seem contrary to the thrust of many of the other arguments which seek to hold that non-members don't have to pay for any union expenses. This is a case actually brought by union members, and therefore is perhaps the most radical First Amendment theory being asserted. And finally, there are some cases pending that involve private sector so-called right-to-work laws. There are a couple of cases now pending in which unions argue that state right-to-work laws violate the National Labor Relations Act insofar as they preclude agreements that would require workers to pay for the basic expenses of servicing the collective bargaining agreement, processing grievances, and negotiating the agreement, and that the requirement that unions represent the entire bargaining unit, including workers who aren't paying anything, would be a taking under the Takings Clause of the Constitution. Those cases were filed not that long ago, and right now the precedents in some court foreclose that argument, and the effort is to get the courts to reconsider. So those are the main issues being litigated right now, and with that I'll throw things back to Bill.
Thank you. And no, I think that pretty much covers the waterfront. I mean, as the listeners can tell, there's a lot of different types of litigation going on, you know, after Harris and Knox. And so as opposed to getting into the details of any of them, I think it's probably best to throw things open for questions and see exactly what, you know, people are interested in hearing more about.
All right. Thanks, Bill. We will now open the floor to audience questions. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, if you'd like to request the floor, please enter star and then the pound key. We don't have any questions on the line right now, so I think we'll move ahead with the discussion a bit. Please, though, at any point, enter star and the pound key, and we'll get you on the line as soon as we can. We do have a question now, actually, so let's answer this first caller. Please join our queue, and you'll be up next by hitting star and then pound.
Yes, I understand the Railway Labor Act governing labor relations in the railroad and airline industries does not have anything like 14B of the National Labor Relations Act, so state right-to-work laws don't apply in the railroad and airline industries. What kind of practical effect does that have in labor relations and unions getting union security clauses and collective bargaining agreements, say in the airline industry, for example?
Sure, I'll take the first step. That, as you said, right-to-work laws, state right-to-work laws, do not apply to the Railway Labor Act employers because you don't have that opt-out, that 14B that exempts such state laws from preemption. However, the court has held that because of that, actually, that lack of preemption, that the First Amendment applies to Railway Labor Act cases. So the constitutional standard that Scott and I were discussing earlier, Abood and such, actually applies to the Railway Labor Act. And so many of these cases brought under Section 1983 arise under the National Labor Relations Act, and the courts have treated them the same in terms of what procedures are required and what can be charged. So for a Railway Labor Act employee, yes, right-to-work laws don't apply, but the same Abood dichotomy applies. They can't be forced to pay for politics and ideological activities, but can be required to pay for collective bargaining and things related to that.
And I guess I would add that there's a question whether the court's analysis, which started with Railway Employees v. Hansen, that there is state action involved in a private agreement between a Railway Labor Act employer and a union that requires payment of fair share fees, is consistent with subsequent Supreme Court decisions about state action. The court had, back in Railway Employees v. Hansen, said that there was a First Amendment overlay to the Railway Labor Act, but it has subsequently suggested that might not be right.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, that could be, you know, something that a future Supreme Court takes, because that argument has been made in some Railway Labor Act cases now. Since obviously Hansen's still controlling, only the Supreme Court could change the law on that. But, you know, that could be an issue the court takes, you know, someday in the future.
Well, we're still hoping to get a second question on the line here. I encourage you to be that next questioner by hitting star and then the pound key. And here is another speaker on the line now. So we'll take this call. Please star and then pound to join the queue after this next caller.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. I thought that Rebecca Friedrichs argued very persuasively in her brief that with respect to her specifically, there was no free rider problem. She is an elementary school teacher in California who argued that the union's collective bargaining positions worked against her interests and that she would prefer to be evaluated on her own merits. She did not benefit from having students passed on to her grade by incompetent teachers, essentially, in the lower grades who were protected by union rules and so forth. How do the panelists respond to that argument where the employees' interests obviously differ on the collective bargaining front from that of the position taken by the union?
Good question. Do you want me to take the first shot at it, Scott, or do you want to?
Sure, you go ahead.
Okay, I think that's sort of a good question is for this tee up the free rider discussion, because one of the main rationales behind Abood and everything subsequent to it is this idea of free rider. So I think I'll give some of the arguments against that rationale, then perhaps Scott can give some of the arguments for it. And then, of course, the future Supreme Court is for decide whether or not the free rider argument is still valid. One of the arguments Ms. Friedrichs made is the one the caller identified, which is, you know, they're not getting something that they necessarily want. That sometimes the unions bargain for things that disadvantage the individual employee, and they shouldn't be forced to pay for something that harms their interest or that they don't want. A second argument, it's often sort of called the forced rider argument. It's the idea that individuals aren't getting a free ride, but rather they're forced to accept the union's representation whether they like it or not, or going back to the earlier idea, whether it benefits them or not. And generally speaking, individuals can't be required to pay for things they neither requested, you know, nor wanted. I mean, so for example, if I come home from work today and my neighbor has mowed my lawn without me asking, he couldn't say, you now owe me $100 for mowing my lawn. Well, I didn't ask him to do it. Maybe I didn't think he did a good job. So you can't force a benefit on someone usually and then say, you owe me money for it. Another argument is the idea that exclusive representation is not a burden on a union for which they deserve compensation, which sort of the free rider argument presumes, but rather exclusive representation is an incredible benefit for a union. It's an incredible power in that it gives unions the authority to speak and contract for everyone in a bargaining unit, whether they like it or not, which greatly increases the union's leverage, and also gives the union the ability to force the employer or public employer to listen to the union. And so, you know, the idea that a union should be paid for it, for something that's a great benefit, is somewhat, you know, counterintuitive. If anything, exclusive representation helps a union gain more members. And then sort of the final idea, which is argued in Friedrichs, is the idea that it's not the least restrictive means. The constitutional standard, exacting standard scrutiny, which Harris and Knox made clear applies to compulsory fees, requires that compelled association not only be justified by compelling government interest, but also be the least restrictive means for that interest. And there's relatively strong evidence to show that unions don't need compulsory fees to act as exclusive representatives, that they can perform those functions even without those compulsory fees, because in many right-to-work states, in fact, in all right-to-work states in the private sector, you know, there are still unions that still exist and still function, notwithstanding the lack of compulsory fees. So it's very difficult, I think, for unions to prove that compulsory fees are the least restrictive means required for exclusive representation. So those are some of the arguments made in the Friedrichs brief and also by some of their amici, you know, attacking this free rider rationale. But obviously there were some counter arguments to them, and I think Scott can probably sum them up better than I can.
Sure. Thanks, Bill. The collective bargaining systems in the United States are essentially universally based on democratic systems of exclusive representation, where the workers in a bargaining unit can democratically select a representative that then has a legal responsibility to bargain a contract that will apply to everyone in the unit, regardless of whether they choose to be members. They'll all get the wage increases, they'll all get the health benefits, and the union will have a legal duty to represent them all in grievances, if they have any. And as Justice Scalia had explained in his concurrence in Leonard, when the government imposes a duty on the representative to represent the entire unit, it can compel everyone in the unit to pay their fair share for that governmentally required representation. You know, we acknowledge that there are always going to be certain people in a democratic system that won't agree with the majority, just like there are some people who wouldn't want to pay their taxes for military spending because they don't agree with it and don't think that it benefits them. But when you have a system like this that's a government-mandated system of representation that creates the free rider problem, the government has an interest in solving the problem by spreading the costs of the government-mandated representation among everyone in the unit. So I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Well, we don't have any other questions on the line right now. I invite our audience members to join the queue by hitting star and then pound. While we wait to see if anyone joins, Bill, do you want a chance to respond to anything that you just heard from Scott?
But no, I think that pretty much, you know, summarizes the argument. And, you know, the briefs in Friedrichs, you know, have a lot on this, you know, in terms of the back and forth about the free rider rationale and its benefits. I mean, the main thing I would say is that, you know, unions, you know, want this. You know, they voluntarily assume the powers of exclusive representation. So I wouldn't frame it as something imposed on a union. It's something unions want, which is made pretty clear that whenever a state tries to roll back, you know, the powers of a union to act as an exclusive representative, you know, they vigorously oppose it. You look at, say, Wisconsin with Act 10 under Governor Walker, who restricted, you know, the union's authority and duty to bargain, and that was, you know, very vigorously opposed. Same thing with SB 5 in Ohio. So I just find it difficult to except that, you know, the power to speak in contract for everyone is a burden. I see it as a great benefit. But ultimately, and this sort of maybe goes to a second point, is that regardless of the arguments, at the end of the day, you know, only the Supreme Court can overrule Abood. I mean, some of the other issues we discussed, you know, could arguably be resolved by lower courts without Supreme Court intervention. But Abood being the law of the land, only the Supreme Court can overrule it. And whether it does that really depends on who the next justice is, which in turn depends on who wins the election. So a lot of this is really, you know, it just depends who's going to be the, you know, the ninth justice, Justice Scalia's replacement. And that'll just, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, we have picked up two questions now, three actually, so we'll answer them in the order that they were received. Please join our queue at any point here by hitting star and then the pound key. Let's go to our first pending question.
Mr. Cronlin mentioned litigation against state right to work laws. Has the Supreme Court ever considered the constitutionality of state right to work laws, and what was the result of that, if it has? And have any of the right to work laws ever been held unconstitutional?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that, as a general matter, Section 14B of the National Labor Relations Act allows state laws that preclude membership in unions, and that the membership has been construed to include having to pay the equivalent of full union dues. The Supreme Court has never squarely addressed the issue whether 14B authorizes state laws that preclude agreements that would require workers to pay anything to the union, including service fees for just the costs of representation, as opposed to the equivalent of full dues. The Supreme Court reserved that issue in a case called Retail Employees v. Schmellerhorn. The lower courts have not invalidated state right to work laws that bar agreements that cover any union fees. There are two circuits that have rejected such challenges, but the Supreme Court has never squarely ruled on it, and these cases seek to bring the issue either in different circuits or to get the circuit to reconsider or take it to the Supreme Court. There are cases that have held that right-to-work laws go too far. For instance, if they bar hiring hall fees or they interfere with checkoff requirements. And these lawsuits essentially contend that the particular state right-to-work laws go too far.
Yes, and I think, and this really comes down to more, I think, of a statute. Well, there's both a statutory and a constitutional argument. I'm not aware of any state right-to-work law being declared unconstitutional, except for in the sense of, you know, supremacy clause preemption. If the right-to-work law went further than, this is, again, speaking of the private sector, went further than Section 14B allows. And just to sort of offer some background for those who aren't aware of how this whole structure is set up in the private sector, Section 14B of the National Labor Relations Act, which is 29 U.S.C. 164, basically says that states are allowed to enact laws prohibiting agreements between employers and unions that require membership in a labor organization. So the magic word there becomes membership. And what Scott's alluding to is whether or not membership includes lesser forms of union fees. In other words, not full union membership or full union dues, which would be the same as membership, but also to include lesser fees, such as the agency fee. And so that's the argument currently being presented. He said two circuits have said that right-to-work laws do include such fees. And really the primary reason for it is that the word membership in terms of compulsory fees is used elsewhere in the statute, and elsewhere has been construed to include lesser fees. So, for example, Communication Workers versus Beck. That's the case that basically holds in the private sector under the National Labor Relations Act, employees can't be forced to pay for collective bargaining, or can be forced to pay for collective bargaining and the like, but not politics, a case very similar to Abood. And the Beck decision hinged its interpretation on interpreting the word membership in a different part of the National Labor Relations Act and said, to avoid constitutional issues, we construe membership to allow the charging of these fees. So the argument in favor of the right to work laws is that, well, if Beck construes membership in 883 to mean fees, then membership in 14B also includes fees, if the two are mirror images of one another. So that's the statutory argument that's being litigated in, what is it right now, Idaho, which is in the Ninth Circuit, and Wisconsin in the Seventh. Although in Wisconsin, there's already an appellate court decision rejecting that, but there was a close en banc vote, and it looks like that's moving its way in that direction. And then just sort of one more step beyond that, I mentioned there's also the constitutional issue. As part of those right to work law challenges, there's also a takings clause challenge being alleged by the unions, mainly that if the right to work laws are construed to prohibit the unions from charging these lesser fees, then this amounts to a taking of the union's property without just compensation in violation of the Constitution's taking clause. The idea being that the taking is of the union's services as a representative, and the lack of compensation is the lack of forced fees. And those are sort of newer issues within the federal court system. And if anyone wants to talk about the details of that, I'm sure we'd both be amenable to so doing.
All right, we still have two questions pending. We'll move to the next one now. Please enter star and then the pound key if you'd like to join our questioning queue.
One of the things that was striking about the oral argument in Friedrichs was the union lawyer's concessions that the line between chargeable and non-chargeable expenses perhaps should be moved. Are there any litigation matters that you're aware of that are addressing that and arguing that more things should be non-chargeable?
Well, I'll take a shot at that. I'm not aware of any cases going on right now regarding chargeability categories, and I think where that line of questioning was going was something the court said in Harris, which is the idea is that if you're measuring things by how political they are, how much of a matter of public concern, there's no good way to divide it. And so one of the discussions that came up is at the oral argument was, well, isn't bargaining over wages, that's surely a big political matter. I mean, how much you pay teachers has a big effect on the budget and taxes. And those sort of agreed, and then the counter-argument goes, well, what about erasers? You know, nobody cares how many erasers there are in a classroom. And so the idea is there's this spectrum of really how political or important it is. And I think the court's point is it's impossible to separate the wheat from the chaff or to make any kind of discernible line there between what is truly chargeable and what is truly not chargeable. And since you can't really distinguish it as a practical matter, even if you agreed there was a continuum, it should all just be non-chargeable. So the idea, I think, was not so much in terms of categories of expenses, which are more or less pretty much most of the litigation's done in the wake of Leonard and another case called Ellis, but more of even within those categories of expenses, it's very difficult to tell what should be chargeable and what isn't. And then also the second part of that, sort of a follow-on, is that since the unions control chargeability, in other words, they get to decide, at least in the first instance, what's chargeable and what's not, that creates an additional issue because the unions obviously have an incentive to charge as much as they possibly can. And so you have the union making the first judgment, at least, although it can be later challenged, as to what should be considered chargeable and not chargeable, and that's such a vague, fuzzy line to start with. You know, where does the system just can't work. So I think it was really a workability argument overall. And I think that I believe it was actually the Solicitor General of California had a lot of trouble, you know, with that line of argument because he said, well, maybe the test should be changed. And Justice Roberts, I believe, if I remember correctly, challenged him and said, well, change to what? And the Solicitor General of California really had no answer, you know, as to what the new test would be. How do you make a test that separates, you know, political collective bargaining from non-political, so to speak. So that sort of was my take on it.
And I guess this is Scott. My take is that when the court decided Abood, it recognized that there would be issues that have to be resolved about where the line is between the chargeable expenses germane to collective bargaining, and the non-chargeable expenses. It recognized that there would be issues, and since 1977, we had a series of cases about how to draw the line. And except, you know, for some minor issues at the margins, those issues were resolved after Abood. And I don't think that there was a concession that the line should be moved. I think the argument was more that some of the arguments being made in Friedrichs for overturning Abood were really arguments about moving the line. In other words, some arguments that certain things were political and that workers shouldn't have to pay for them were more accurately arguments for moving the line than for overruling Abood entirely. And in terms of the line, from my perspective, the line was established in litigation. Auditors know where it is, unions know where it is, and except, you know, for occasional questions on the margins, litigation about that seems to have essentially died. And I'm not aware of any significant cases that are pending right now about the line.
Okay, we have one final question here. Please enter star and pound, and we will put you on right after this next caller.
David Emerson with the San Francisco chapter. When I look at and try to understand the rationale for the mandatory collective bargaining with the teachers, it strikes me that, you know, what it arises from is an assumption that there's a failure in the marketplace, the normal employer-employee marketplace, where employers and employees work out their own individual deals. And because of that failure in the marketplace, which is largely due to, you know, I presume, is the compulsory and exclusive nature of education, at least in this part of the market, that's the rationale. That may or may not be the case, so I'd like to get your sense of whether that is. But my question has to do with, you know, if there's a change in the landscape, in sort of the market landscape, and we start seeing more charter schools, more voucher programs, more alternatives to, you know, what used to be a large unified block of employer-employee relationships as embodied in the typical public school system, if we see more of these alternatives, I mean, could the argument be made, or has the argument been made, that it really undermines the fundamental rationale of why we need mandatory collective bargaining in the first place in this part of the market?
I think I'll try to take a shot at that, and that's a good question. You know, how does sort of the addition of, you know, some choice through vouchers and such affect the idea of the collective bargaining system? And what you see, though, is that most charter schools, but not all, there can be still collective bargaining. It depends on whether how they're structured, whether that's under state law, in other words, they consider a state employer, or as it seems to be more common nowadays, under the National Labor Relations Act. So let's say you're a private sector school and not completely a religious institution. You're an employer under the National Labor Relations Act, most likely, and you can be unionized under that act like any other public sector or any other sort of private sector employee like a factory. So you still have collective bargaining. It just changes the scope. So, for example, a union may be, you know, bargaining with the entire school district. While on another hand, with the various charter schools, if it is school by school, then you have bargaining only about a particular school or perhaps, you know, maybe a number of schools owned by the same private company. So in terms of the larger, let's say, education market in any given area, you do have more unions and more competition, which indirectly goes at the idea of the labor peace argument. Because the labor peace, so-called labor peace rationale, is sort of the government justification for collective bargaining. The idea being you need one exclusive representative because dealing with multiple representatives and multiple employees would disrupt peace and harmony within the workplace. So that's usually about one facility at a time. But, you know, I guess you could extrapolate that to some degree if you had an entire district and you had, you know, multiple unions and multiple structures for bargaining. And, of course, with the charters, you know, many schools that aren't unionized at all.
And I'll just add to that that collective bargaining systems serve multiple purposes. Originally, in the private sector, collective bargaining statutes arose because of a disparity in bargaining power. The findings in the National Labor Relations Act are that the individual unorganized worker was powerless to secure adequate terms and conditions of employment, and the National Labor Relations Act was adopted explicitly to enable workers to organize together to have more bargaining power vis-a-vis the employer and to improve their wages and working conditions. And historically, that's been one purpose of collective bargaining. Another purpose of collective bargaining, which we see in the public sector, is allowing the workers to be involved in setting the terms and conditions of their own employment, to have a voice at work, as is often said. And there were experiments in the public sector with collective bargaining systems that were not based on exclusive representation, where you had, you know, a union that would bargain only for its own members, and then another union that might bargain only for its members, such that you would have, say, multiple different unions representing different groups of teachers. And the consensus was that those systems were failures, and that if you're going to have a stable collective bargaining system that benefits both the employer and the employees, the one that works is a democratic system where you have the election of a single representative to negotiate a contract. And from a First Amendment perspective, one might imagine whether it would be worse to have a system in which the union represented only its own members and could bargain an agreement whereby its own members got higher wages and better benefits than workers who did not join the union. In the public sector, it might be argued that that's the system that would pose a greater burden on First Amendment rights. You know, we don't think that exclusive representation, you know, as such poses any burden right now, but one could argue that that's the system that would burden the First Amendment because the workers would have an incentive to become union members so they enjoyed the higher wages and benefits.
We have picked up one additional question here, so we'll move to that caller now. We'll have a bit of time left after this question and answer. Please hit star and then the pound key if you'd like to join the queue.
My name is Bruce Cameron. I'm a member of the faculty section of the Federalist Society, and the thing that Scott just said caused me to ask a question. He was saying that this idea of multiple party bargaining was rejected as a failure and people moved to exclusive representation instead. I wanted to ask him about what's happened in Tennessee in the last 4 years, I believe it was, where the Tennessee teachers went from a system of exclusive representation to a multiple party bargaining system, very similar to what you have in certain countries in Europe. And it seems to me that that's an example, a modern example, of the state deciding that exclusive representation is not the best way forward. Multiple party representation is. And I know, just as an additional fact, that only the United States and Canada have exclusive representation. The rest of the world, where they have union representation, is all multiple bargaining representation.
I'm not familiar with what's going on in Tennessee. That would be, you know, very unusual for the United States. I wasn't aware that anyone was experimenting with a system of non-exclusive representation. The last systems I was aware of in the public sector were in the 50s and maybe the 60s. So, you know, that would be unusual. I agree that other countries have different collective bargaining systems that often involve sectoral bargaining and proportional representation, and many of those countries have higher rates of union membership. But in the United States, there were debates at the time of the National Labor Relations Act about whether exclusive representation was the way to go. And the judgment was made in the National Labor Relations Act of exclusive representation. And I wasn't aware that Tennessee was now experimenting with something else.
Yes, it's been in place for several years.
Bill, do you want to comment on that before we move on to our next question?
No, I don't necessarily have anything to follow on. I think Mr. Cameron sort of summed up what I know about Tennessee, that they're experimenting with it. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that experiment ultimately resolves.
Okay, we do have one more question on the line, so we'll go to that caller now. Please enter star and then the pound key if you'd like to ask your question following this next caller.
Earlier in the discussion, the constitutional challenges to right-to-work laws under the Takings Clause were mentioned. I'm curious as to what the arguments against that challenge are, and have any courts ruled on such challenges so far?
Sure, Scott, do you want to lay out what the arguments are for it, and then I'll sort of go against it, or?
Sure. The takings arguments were discussed in the Seventh Circuit's decision in Sweeney v. Pence, with Judge Wood in dissent explaining why, in her view, state right-to-work laws would violate the Takings Clause if they required the union to provide services to bargaining unit members for free by precluding them from having an agreement to collect a service fee. The government would be imposing a system in which the union had a duty of fair representation to non-members, but the union was precluded from recouping a fee to cover the costs of that representation, thereby resulting in a taking of the cost of the union's services. And the majority in Sweeney v. Pence rejected her analysis. So the arguments, you know, are partly laid out there.
Yes, and the just sort of go with what they said in Sweeney was basically that the union's compensated by its authority at the bargaining table. That the exclusive representation, while it comes with duties, it also comes with many powers and benefits, and that as part of the deal, the benefits, you know, eliminate any taking. And you can sort of put that, the benefits of exclusive representation, in a couple different places in the takings analysis, but that was the core of the decision. You also had a similar decision, similar idea by the Indiana Supreme Court, a case called Zoller, and this is also being litigated now in Wisconsin State Court. It's on appeal of whether or not there's a taking. And again, there's a lot of arguments that can be made under the takings analysis, but I think the core comes down to exclusive representation comes with a lot of benefits and maybe some duties, but you can't, in takings analysis, only look at the duty. So, for example, if a government contractor said, hey, I accept $100,000 in pavement or payment for paving the road, you can't turn around and say, oh, well, paving the road cost me more than $100,000, therefore it's a taking. The contractor took the deal, you know, and same with a union. When a union chooses to be an exclusive representative, it takes the good with the bad. And so it just can't say, you know, the bad is a taking without factoring in the good. And then a sort of a second issue you sort of have there, which just makes the whole issue rather unusual, is that to the extent there's anyone suffering a taking here, it's the individual employee. Because really what the union's arguing is a right under the takings clause to take money from an employee. Again, usually a takings case is someone is suing the government, saying the government owes me compensation for taking something. Here the unions are arguing under the takings clause that it gives them a right to take money from individual employees, in this case private citizens, if we're talking about the private sector. So arguably, to the extent there is a taking here, it's an individual employee who should be bringing that takings claim against the union, because it's the employee who's having something taken from him, you know, against his will.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, one might analogize it to a law that required lawyers to provide services for free without permitting them to reach agreements to be paid fees by a client. It's not a perfect analogy, but one could certainly argue that a law that required lawyers to do that would be a taking of the lawyer's services in order to serve what the government thought was a public purpose, and that this system is like that in that it forces the union to provide services for free to non-members. So,
haven't such schemes been upheld by the courts, though?
Certain schemes have been upheld on a theory that lawyers are officers of the court that can be required to do that.
All right, we have no questions on the line now. We do have a couple more minutes, so let's make a final call for questions. This is your last chance to enter star and then the pound key to get a chance to ask a question of either of our experts. But seeing none, do you have any closing thoughts, either of you, before we adjourn the call?
None in particular. I think that, as this discussion's indicated, the big question, will Abood survive, really just depends on who the next justice is, and that's, more of a political question that neither of us can answer. But even besides Abood, there's all kinds of other issues going on right now in this area that can be resolved by the lower courts, and so it'll be exciting to watch what happens over the next year.
Yes, and I have nothing to add. I just want to thank you for inviting me to participate in this, and I would agree that with regard to the big issues, who the next Supreme Court justice is likely to determine whether the Supreme Court is interested in revisiting what had been settled law.
Well, thank you both for giving us your time and joining us today. Thank you as well to our very engaged audience for their attendance and all of their questions. We hope to hear from a lot of you for our next Teleforum conference call. It'll be Monday afternoon at 2 p.m. We'll discuss the CFPB's arbitration rule. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.